Hello, welcome to Pod on the Parish. This is episode 15. We are still in the heat wave. I've got Alex here. He's pretty smug, aren't you today, Alex?
I am indeed. My wife, in her infinite wisdom, back in winter of last year, said we need aircon. It seemed frivolous at the time, but I'm very, very grateful for that right now.
Yeah, I have seen actually on the Instagram, I've seen lots of funny reels with people who actually did that exact scenario, who got their aircon and are feeling very proud of themselves.
I won't be proud of my electricity bill when it comes through, though.
Yeah, I imagine your wife is letting everyone know the situation. Yeah.
I think so. I think we're going to have lots of guests and visitors over for dinner. But no, it is a luxury that I'm very, very pleased to have right now.
So where are you based?
We're based in Norwich in Norfolk.
Okay, and what? So I know your name is Alex. Tell me more about you.
Sure. So my name is Alex Jay. I'm managing director over at Little Green Button, a panic digital safety and panic alarm company, and we help keep staff safe. Been with the company now for 7 years. It's a really interesting time for us. The topic that we're talking about today, Martin's Law, is really shaking things up and bringing safety to the forefront of people's minds. So while I want everyone to take safety seriously, it's a bit of carrot and stick where you want people to do that. Not always the directive for them to do so, to have some legislation and have a law change which makes people discuss safety, get them thinking about it, what that means for their colleagues and what that means for their communities. I think it's a really exciting time for us. So a lot of change in the industry, but lots of learning and educating for people to do in a proportionate way.
Cool. Yeah, you're jumping way ahead. So what were you doing before Little Green Button? Did you go to uni and rewind a little bit?
My background. So yeah, I went and studied international studies at university. So really broad background in economics and politics. I really found an affinity with data. Really, really enjoyed looking at stats and analysing them. My first role out of university was in market research. So studied going to events, surveying people, getting those statistics back and learning what they could do.
Oh, you're one of those annoying people, were you?
Oh, yeah. But you got freebies, right? We always had good giveaways. There'd be a free battery pack or a USB at the time was golden.
Okay.
But that's stats, and that led on to data science, larger data sets, and then working in marketing, property management as well. So I got access to some really large data sets and looking at how we could help influence boards and different departments around, so you could use data to make better decision making. And it gave me a really good exposure to life and business. I was fortunate enough to have access to lots of different departments, lots of different data.
Who was that with?
So it was at Firstport for the property management company, and before that a local company called Optimize that did the marketing side of things.
Oh yeah, Optimize, Norwich based, but they're a big company, aren't they?
They are indeed, yeah, working across lots of different territories there.
So you're CEO of Little Green Button. Were you the CEO from the beginning? Is it your company? Did you found it?
No, so our founder, John Whitty, had two different companies, Engage Health and Little Green Button. Little Green Button, a product that's been around for a little while, but showed quite a lot of potential. It didn't have a team around it or a defined strategy. So John found me and we worked together to sort of build that up, really. So the company, I was employee number one in there, but the product had been going for a little while under a different guise, but gave that some love and a strategy and hoping fulfill that to its maximum potential. Because it's
okay. So is there actually a Little Green Button? I mean, what, it's a bit of a weird name for a company to be honest, but yeah, is there a Little Green Button? What's the story there?
There is indeed. So this digital panic alarm software on your desktop, on your mobile device, we even have some physical hardware, and it does stand out on your desktop. It's always there, so you know you can call for help when you need it, and it just appears on your desktop, your mobile device as a little green button. So not threatening and very welcoming, so people know that they can use it, shouldn't be afraid to press it and get help from their colleagues when they give that a purchase.
So what's the most popular kind of customer, let's say, who uses it? What's the scenario? What are you, yeah, any yeah, success people, stories?
Yeah, people dealing with the general public, frontline staff. So
frontline
our inception
staff
was in the NHS and healthcare. So receptionists, GP surgeries, maybe there's been a delay, someone's aggravated, maybe there's been a medical emergency. You want to deal with that situation at hand so you can press the panic alarm and let your colleagues know that you need assistance. And from there, it's really, really spread everything from US courthouses to universities in Canada, lots of different application for it. More mass notification now, as we have added different alert types like medical, lockdown, intruder, and our lone working functionality, supporting those people that might be working in isolation as well, so that their friends and colleagues, or even escalate that up to an alarm response center, people can always get help on the move. So inception in healthcare, but yeah, spreading out to lots of different sectors.
Button on the desk, physical one or on your desktop, or your and you hit it and people come running.
That's it, yeah. And you can choose who gets notified, what they're getting notified with. So give a bit of control over that, because you might not want to panic everyone in the building. You might just want the health and safety team or a
Cool.
first aider to come running. So allow them to
Awesome.
customize that.
Oh, nice. So yes, you're talking about Martin's Law today. On the topic, what's a common mistake or misconception regarding it?
I'd say the biggest misconception is the scope of how this applies. It's still in an implementation phase, although it achieved Ascent back in 2025. There's 2 years now where it's being implemented and they're engaging with the general public and they're providing more guidance. Lots of people have jumped the gun, maybe purchased solutions they didn't need to, paid for consulting, even cancelled events speculatively, not knowing how the guidance applies. So I think the biggest misconception is people are assuming that this already applies to them. Or it's going to cost them a lot of money and it's going to be a negative thing without fully understanding the scope of what this really is. And that's something I'm hoping to clarify for people today.
Awesome. And before we jump into the webinar, looks like we do have 267 people registered, and I can
Wonderful.
see the waiting room building up right now. But before we do that, is there anything that people don't know? Share something a little bit personal about yourself that might not know about you.
Oh, I've got an exclusive. I've just signed up to do my motorbike direct access course. So lots of time spent with family recently. I'm doing something a little bit selfish for me now. I've always wanted to have a motorbike. I did my CBT, just the training part of that lapsed. But I've signed up for a direct access course. So I'm going to try
That's a
and
1 week.
quite intensive by the sounds of it, but I'm really excited for that. And it is a little bit selfish, but my dad's been driving a motorbike and it's on our bucket list to go on a trip together. So I'm really excited to get my license and plan an exciting trip somewhere.
Awesome. Yeah, I did that course. I did it in central London.
Oh,
So,
wow. Trial by fire.
in 2000, yeah, 1999 or something like that. But yeah, no, yeah, I gave up driving when, first kid. But yeah, you'll love it. That sense of freedom. Yeah, and it'd be nice, yeah, to go do some plan some road trips with your dad. That's awesome.
Thank you so much, John. And guys, that was really, really interesting. These events, I'm not a counterterrorism expert. My background, John said, mass notification, emergency notification, and lone worker safety. That's the product and the service that we provide. But Martin's Law is impacting a lot of communities. When the law came out and was announced, ripples went through everywhere from schools, town and local councils. On a personal level, events that I've been looking forward to, local steam rally. People have seen the law, seen some. There hasn't been 100% clarification on the guidance, and they just thought, you know what, we're volunteers, we'll just cancel it. A fireworks display, as you mentioned, a bit of nuance around the rules of this, and it's making people scared. And you guys have already got enough on your plate, so I'm hoping today, I'd really like to signpost you to some really good guidance. We'll run through a couple of examples of what this means, learn a little bit about why this has come about, and how it actually is a force for good, and how it's going to help people. So what I'd love to do now is just share my screen with you. Go back to the start there. One of the big things that everyone's talking about, Martin's Law, is all about a proportionate response. I'm not expecting anyone here to be counterterrorism experts. The risk for a lot of people, fortunately, is super, super low. So while the legislation sounds quite heavy, some of the examples we're going to talk about seem quite extreme. We've got to ground this in reality and proportionate response. I'm hoping by the end of this, when we've been through it, you'll have a bit of clarity on the scope of what the law actually entails. I mentioned proportionate. Actually, I think for a lot of you here today and some of the examples we've spoken about, you're not going to incur huge overheads. There shouldn't be a cost increase. There might be a bit of extra paperwork, but hopefully I can get you justified why that is a good thing and how that's going to help and mitigate some of the risk and give you a couple of actions that you can do. I'm not trying to give people homework. As I said, like, there's not cost, there's not tools to go out and buy, there might not be consultancy, but there might be a couple of things that you can go away with the tools that you've got to hand that will get you ahead of this. And we'll talk about some of the timings around this as well. So, got there at the bottom. This isn't about scaremongering. I know it sounds quite heavy. And especially when we talk about what Martin's Law actually is, the official title of the Terrorism Protection of Premises Act of 2025. That does sound quite heavy. And a lot of you are thinking, how's that going to relate to a parish or a town council? But in essence, this received royal assent, so it became legitimate in April of 2025, and there was a legal framework around it. It's responsible for certain publicly accessible premises and events to make sure people stay safe. And it makes sure that if the worst were to happen, people were prepared, they knew how to communicate effectively, and they'd thought about proper precautions ahead of time. As we mentioned before, it was the Manchester Arena bombing. that took place in 2017, where 22 people were tragically murdered. One of those people, Martin Hett, his mother, really brave lady, fortunate enough to listen to her at the Martin Store conference last week, where she was giving a bit more context around this. She's been campaigning ever since, just for so public premises, and people have thought ahead and been a bit prepared for if the worst were to happen. There's been a lot of studies into some of the small things that we can do to make sure if there was a tragedy or an emergency situation, that just a couple of small things, thinking ahead, having plans and policy in place, can really, really help in response times. And we'll talk a little bit about how this law and what they're trying to achieve with it when we go through some specific examples there. So it's not trying to scare people. We talk about proportionate response, but it's saying about being prepared. And that doesn't have to incur huge cost. It doesn't have to incur specialist tools or overheads. We'll talk about those examples as we run through. So the timeline of where we were, I mentioned this cheap royal assent that happened in 2025. What's happened then is that the Home Office, in the meantime, has said there's going to be a 2-year implementation period. What they're doing is they're providing specific guidance, and more's coming out over time, because when it initially was announced, everyone thought, oh, the scope of this is massive. Actually, a school is publicly accessible, a church is. Village halls, parks, whoa, so many questions opened up. But the Security Industry Authority and the Home Office in the time since have said, yep, we've got a 2-year implementation period. Let's start getting people ready for this. So duties and obligations right now, nothing's being enforced. But in spring of next year, and when the Security Industry Authority, they're going to launch a new online portal, we'll talk about that in a little bit, that's when things could be starting to get enforced. Some of this, the dates might move ever so slightly. So I'm going to mention the Home Office and the Security Industry Authority at the end of this, and maybe afterwards, I'll share a couple of links for you guys where you can sign up for mailing lists. You can get specific examples. There are some great flow charts, but there's some of the governing bodies that we're talking about. But 2025, that's when it got royal assent. Spring of next year is when we're looking at things actually getting enforced. So we've got a really good amount of time now. You guys are doing exactly the right thing of learning, educating yourselves. We've got a really good opportunity to clarify things and ask questions up until things do become enforced. On that timeline there, you can see in early next year, there's a notification portal. We may have an obligation to register certain premises or events on a portal. That's going to help emergency response if something were to happen. They had a bit of background about where the place is, what was going on, the type of events that are happening, maybe even some of the preparations and policies that are in place for that specific venue. So it gives emergency responders one place where they can see all these different events and portals happening for a bit of information sharing. It also gives the Security Industry Authority a chance where sometimes people do run unsafe events. They do happen from time to time, and it does give people a chance to make sure that everything's happening is legitimate and structured. And when they do come to enforcing this, there's proper policy and procedure behind it. So I'm not going to make you read section 27 and this full 400 pages of guidance and examples, but we're going to talk about, and you're going to see some common terms here. So it's about us getting familiar with them. When we talk about premises, there's someone rightly said that we've got a couple of bandings here. And we're talking specifically about a premises, a building. Standard tier, anything below a premises where 200 people, if it doesn't have a capacity of, if it's below 200, oh, sorry, Vicky. Thank you. If your premises is below 200 people, you're exempt. That doesn't mean that you don't have to think about health and safety. It doesn't mean you shouldn't think about these things, but actually, according to the guidance, you're exempt. When we go above 200 people, and that's where people are expected at the same time, and there's a bit of frequency behind it. So that could be a regular Christmas party in a premises, happens every year that gets booked out, and we expect 250 people. That falls in standard tier. The enhanced tier is when generally we've got a premises where we're expecting 800 people. It's got a capacity of 800 people or more, and that's happening on the regular. So it's does it have that capacity, and is it fulfilling that on a regular basis? So that's where we talk about enhanced tier. So we've got exempt 0 to 200, standard tier 200 up to 800, and then enhanced tier is 800 more. Your obligations, and we'll talk about that, really do differ between non-exempt, standard, and enhanced. What you have to do and what you have to provide are different. We've then got qualifying events. That's a public event where 800 people or more are expected. There's entry conditions and access control. Now, some of this is going to get really nuanced. So just get familiar with the terms. We'll talk about specific examples. But we've got qualifying events, is something you'll see in the terminology. We've got responsible person. So who's got control of the premises or event? That may not necessarily be the owner. You might have a charitable trust or something that's running events or doing that. We may have subcontracted things there, but you've got responsible people. And then we've got some new words. Some of these, I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of in essence until Martinsville came into effect. I'd heard of an evacuation. Be familiar with that when you've got a fire drill. Where do you go? Where's your muster point? But now we've got things like evacuation, lockdown, and communication procedures as well. So I'll share these slides afterwards, but just starting to get familiar with, we've got these standard enhanced tiers. We've got qualifying events. We've got responsible people who have control. And then we've got public protection procedures. So what I'm going to move on to now, just talking about these procedures in plain terms of what they mean. Evacuation, you know it. There's a fire, the fire alarm goes off. Let's get everyone out safely. And you'll know maybe in some of your hiring agreements, if there's a party, actually you have to show people where the fire exits are, where the muster point is, and where the fire extinguisher might be. Who's responsible for calling the emergency services? We're familiar with an evacuation, but now we've got evacuation. Maybe something really dangerous is going on outside. Maybe it's not safe for people to leave your venue, and it's actually safer for them to stay inside. So we've got the idea of an evacuation procedure of actually everyone come inside. We might lock some doors, we might do a certain procedure, having something defined for an evacuation. You're going to see that terminology come in. And obviously, this really depends on the event and the premises and what's going to be suitable. Lockdown alerts. We see these a lot in schools, for example. Maybe there's an intruder in a school. We might ask the school to lock down. Recently, locally for us in North Walsham, actually, there was, it turned out to be an air rifle, I think, but someone was walking around the local community with an air rifle. It went out to the local school that we're going to do a lockdown. Everyone needs to stay in place. The alert's gone out there. So stay in place, stay secure until we hear extra update. And then we've got communication procedures, especially at a large event. What happens if there is a, and again, we're going to think a little bit wider than just a terrorist attack. Let's think about something like a medical emergency. Someone at a fireworks display has had a heart attack. How are we going to communicate with our volunteers, with the people at the event to make sure, what's our communication policy? How do we communicate in these emergency situations? Who's going to be responsible for liaising with the emergency services? How do we make sure our volunteers know what to do and how to communicate? Again, the word proportionate comes in here a lot. Proportionality is, it really does depend on your circumstances. Again, not all of us are running massive events. Not all of us are going to be in scope here. Not all of us, are going to have the ability to contribute in all these different ways. So proportionality comes into the act massively. They just want to see that we've thought about some of these things in advance of what might happen, what might be responsible for if we fall into that standard tier or the enhanced tier. So we'll talk about what you actually have to do and if you fall into those brackets. But again, they're very, very specific on this. You don't need to go out and buy products, hire consultants, or even pay for training. They're adamant, as it stands at the minute, the Home Office guidelines and what's being provided by the Security Industry Authority, another great resource is Protect UK, is that we should, especially for the standard tier, be able to handle a lot of this stuff in-house with the resources that we've got. I think I saw a quote that they estimated that the 10-year cost for someone falling in standard tier would be about £3,000 to £5,000. I think going, if you're in that enhanced tier, a 10-year cost overall, sort of £50,000 upwards. I'll share the article that came from as well. And that is speculation, but just people thinking about where the cost and the resource might go over 10 years. Thinking about you guys and some of the hats that you have to wear, you'll know this better than I do, but just some of the examples that we've got. Operators, so we've got village halls, town halls, community centres, and pavilions. So we've got these premises that we run. Landowners, so actually where we own the space, we might not necessarily be the operator. That might be let out to, as I said, a charity trust or someone else might be running it. Event organisers, the example that I've got there, markets, fairs, talk about remembrance services, Christmas lights turn on, firework displays. The last one, they're community champions. A lot of you, when we run through this, won't be in scope. Your premises just won't. It won't be in scope. But because you've heard this now, I'm relying on you guys to raise awareness about the proportionality, thinking ahead, what some of the checks and measures that we can do. How can we think ahead and how can we help other people? You might be really close with someone that works at the local school that might be really unaware of Martinsville and a bit worried about it. How can we signpost and be community champions for people that may be impacted? How can we bring people back in? It's horrid to hear that some of these events might be cancelled because people are concerned about the burden. How can we signpost them to some resources and give them the confidence to say, actually, you know what? I think we're going to be okay. It's proportionate. We've looked at the guidance. We are okay to go ahead. You're going to be fine, guys. So that last one there is community champion. I've said it, you're not expected to become counterterrorism experts. You're not expected to know everything. That's why they've given us an implementation period here going into 2027, and they're providing a lot of help and guidance for us to get ready for that. So does it apply to you? This is going to be very, very personal. There is a lot of nuance to the guidance. I want to run through a couple of, we'll go through an exact quote there. So is it reasonable to expect 200 or more people, including staff, to be present at the same time from time to time in a premises? So let's think about what that could mean then. So we've got a building that we rent out and we have a annual meeting that fits in there. Every year, the same thing is happening in this building. It's got a capacity of 300. It's not hitting 300. We know that based on past years, maybe we see about 250 people turn up for this event. Yeah, actually, that is going to fall into the standard tier there. So that's between the 200 and 800. But we know that regularly, that's getting a few more than 200 people in there. That is going to fall into the standard tier. That's quite a simple one. We've got a lot of nuance around this, though, haven't we? Around how often it's filling up to capacity. Just because the maximum capacity of your venue might be 800, actually, if you're never filling it to 800, if it's regular, you're only seeing sort of 50 people at a time, that could be an antenatal group or renting out a hall. And you've got those sorts of events happening. Sure enough, yeah, you might be able to cram 800 people in there, but is it regularly filling that capacity and happening? That's where some of the nuance comes in. So you're going to need to go away and have a think about what are some of those regular bookings? How often is that getting filled up to capacity? Are these one-off things or is it happening every year and is there a pattern to it? We've got to think about access control as well. So there's some exclusion for things like open air parks. So people meeting up, let's say that there is a picnic happening in a park. It's open, it's not ticketed. There's no RSVP, you don't have to buy a ticket to it. There's no gate control, it's not in a restricted area. If it's just a picnic that's being organized, public events and some land are actually exempt on that, open recreation land, for example, and parks. And because it's not a ticketed event, actually that one there will probably be exempt. If it was in a fenced off area, you had to buy a ticket and there would be 800 people attending, that would probably fall into the bracket of a qualifying event there. So this is what I mean about some of the nuance. So open air parks and similar events, actually, if your fireworks display is open to the public, it isn't ticketed, it's not gated, and there isn't access control there, that might be exempt. Might be the same for a remembrance service. If that's just actually it's open, we're doing that. That doesn't mean we don't have to think about safety and security. And we definitely have obligations, health and safety, and there are other laws and legislations. But this is where I mean that some people might have jumped the gun and preemptively cancelled things or worried themselves or think they're going to incur costs. There are very specific criteria here for who is the responsible person, who's exempt and who's not. I'm going to go speak a bit more about some familiar scenarios that we've got here. Village hall with regular 200 plus peaks. Actually, the hall body usually holds the premises duty. You're going to have to think about your hiring agreements. That doesn't mean we need to go overboard. Our hiring agreements. Actually, we need to specify in here a couple of things about what would happen in these scenarios. We need to think about safety and security, maybe some of those communication policies. We fall into that standard tier. We might need to update some of our procedures for that. Private wedding or a party, the hall itself may be standard tier. But the actual wedding inside of that is not a qualifying event. It's not ticketed. It's not going plus 800 people. So again, the hall itself may fall. The premises itself is going to fall into standard tier. That wedding or party that's happening, though, again, in your hiring agreement, you're just going to have to highlight to them what they need to be aware of and some of the things that might have changed in there. Open park event, not automatically in scope. As I said, open recreation land is excluded as premises, but you need to check about control. Entry, realistic attendance. As I said, if it becomes a ticketed event, if there's access control, then we're looking into that enhanced qualifying event scenario where there are certain obligations and it does get a little bit heavier. So yeah, where you've got fence ticketed fare could be a qualifying event in its own right, even if the park that it's sitting on is excluded. Entry conditions, access control, safety procedures, that is going to be a little bit heavier. And again, the Christmas lights turn on, we spoke about that, but it depends on the layout. Again, if there's you could be exempt. Actually, it's not access. There's no access control. It's open to the public. It's happening on public space. You'll see that I noted record the reasoning clearly, though. Just because we think we're exempt, let's just document why we think we're exempt. I'll share afterwards the links here that says standard tier, what your obligations are, why you think you fall in and out of that. Not creating huge overheads, but just having a quick line, have it minuted there that actually, yeah, we've been around our premises. We think these ones are in scope, these ones are out. Here's our reasoning why. The majority of you, if you are going to be in scope, it's probably going to be that standard tier. And again, it's not a huge overhead that there in standard tier. It's just giving some thought around some of these new procedures and your obligations, not going out and buying technology. I'm not the expert on some of these qualifying events, some of these larger ones. If it's a ticketed event with restricted access that's happening in an enclosed space, those ones do have higher obligations. So I can help you know whether you think you're going to qualify for that. Your actual obligations and your security procedures in that are defined by the Security Industry Authority. So I will defer to them for what you need to do there. So talking about some mistakes, panic buying. Wow, some people have gone out and spent budget and they want these events to happen. They've spent loads on tech or consultants or done that. Wow, the Home Office Security Industry Authority, please understand the scope, have a think about it, proportional. And again, assuming everything is in scope, oh, the law's coming, the parks, everything, we need to spend money, we need to worry about it. No, a load of stuff is going to be exempt. Public land, community events don't always qualify. So we can go back and just double check whether our stuff is in scope. But at the same time, don't just say, yeah, listen to a webinar, I think we're out of scope, we're going to bin it off. Please do go and double check these recurring events that are happening, what the maximum capacity is, and whether you're actually the events that you're holding there do regularly fall within that standard tier. Something just to go and check there. So that difference between don't assume everything's in scope, but also don't rule yourselves out and think nothing is in scope. Let's go have a check. Let's have a look at standard tier, higher tier. Check the links that we're going to send over and a couple of flow charts so you can see whether you think you fall into place there. So don't just rule yourselves out of this. And contracting away accountability as well. As we said, hiring agreements, go and check them out. Certain things can be delegated, but let's not just assume that, oh yeah, if someone's running an event on the park, that's their responsibility completely. Some of this stuff is going to have to be collaborative. Some of it's going to need to be explicit about who's got control there. That's an important one of who has got the control. So making sure that we are in our agreements, we're protecting ourselves and the people that are hiring out our venues from us that we're working with on that. And overclaiming compliance. God, you are going to see some stuff out there. I've already seen it. Buy our product and you'll be Martin's Law compliant. Consultants, got one quick visit from me, only 5 grand, and it'll make you compliant. No. You guys are the experts. You know the space. They're trying to make this very, very accessible for us to be able to check ourselves whether we're in scope or not. And if we are in scope, especially in that standard tier, that we can do a lot of stuff ourselves. Again, if you're running a really big event, you can't shy away from some costs around security and the implementation there. There is going to be some extra time and cost there. But watch out for people overclaiming compliance. There's going to be a lot of it because the law's coming into effect and the fact that it's going to be enforced. People are seeing dollar signs and they're trying to spook people into buying things. So don't do that, please. Watch out for anyone that says they can make you compliant. I'd raise an eyebrow at that. This is what I've thought that you guys could go and do. One of the things on there as well, probably should have been number one actually. Go and check the legislation. I'll provide some one pages. I don't want loads of homework for you guys. Security Industry Authority, join the mailing list, have a look at that. Protect UK, they've got the flow charts on there. I've got a building. If yes, if no, and it will really quickly tell you if your premises or your event is going to be in scope or not. So go and check those out. But then, yeah, list out your premises and your regular events. Have them documented, even if they're out of scope. Just please have them there and have a list and say that we've thought about it. This is out of scope, and just have it there minuted. So if you ever were challenged on it, it's there and you've taken that into account. Estimate realistic peak numbers. Again, if it's just going to be a mum's group in there on the regular, that's fine. But actually, oh, you know what? We do have the Christmas party. That happens every single year. We do see about 250 people in there. Yeah, let's have a think about the regular peak numbers for the events that we've listed. Identify who has control in that. Actually, are we opening and unlocking the doors? Are we providing the keys? Have we got staff on site there or our volunteers? Or actually, is it just our land and someone else is responsible for that? So have a think about who's got the control as well in that case. Hiring agreements, what do we need to update? Do we need to have some extra things in there? We mentioned a fire alarm and evacuation. We're all great at saying, here are your exits, here's the muster point. Where do we need to enhance those to have a think about what would happen in slightly different scenarios outside of fire? I know Martin's always talking about terrorism, but there's other things that can happen as well. If there is a medical emergency, if there is I don't know, a gang outside that are making people feel threatened, we spoke about evacuation. Have a think about your hiring agreements, event forms. Include some updated policies, but maybe make things explicit of where you think some of the control and responsibility lies there. These procedures don't need to be heavy. I think it's maybe on another slide. No one's going to read a 50-page pack, let's be honest. A lot of this stuff can be done on one pages. Really simple procedures that are clear for people to follow. Really simple things for volunteers. When this happens, here's how we're going to communicate it. Doesn't need to be overly complicated. As I said, they're not expecting us to become counter-terrorism experts or emergency first responders. Just need to show proportionate rational thinking on this and having it documented. It will really cover our backs. And making sure we're briefing staff, volunteers, and regular hirers. I think a lot of us do this really well. I mentioned the fire alarm thing. That becomes routine for people. There may just be a couple of enhanced things that we need to add into that flow when we speak to people now. And yeah, covering our backs, record the decisions and review it annually. That is the best thing I can say is that showing that you've thought about it, no one's going to beat you up for that. We can just do your best on this. Really do think about it. Record the decisions. Show that you've given it some thought. The lower tiers, the standard tier, even if you're non-exempt, please do record your decision of why you think that and what's going through on that. The standard tier, you won't have as much homework to do there. Again, if you're hitting some of those higher tiers, though, some of these qualifying events that are ticketed in closed premises, or you've got more than 800 people turning up on the regular, there is a whole different track for that that is going to require a little bit more work. But as I said, record your decisions. Cover your backs on that side. And again, I mentioned that the evidence can be really simple. Register checklist. You may already have some of these tables in an app somewhere, ways that you can check some of these things off and just say that you've thought about it. If you're ever questioned on that, I mentioned the governing body, the enforcement on this is coming from the Security Industry Authority. So they've got their portal where we can register some of these events and some of our buildings and premises, but doing it ourselves as well, it's just not going to hurt. Again, where technology can fit into this, walkie-talkies. Alerting tools, ways that we can get speed and help to the right people in certain ways. So, big firework event, maybe someone's fainted or collapsed, or maybe there's someone drunk causing a bit of an issue. How are we going to get help to the right people in the right way? And how do we communicate around that? Deciding who needs to be alerted and what they should do. Do you really want to panic all the volunteers, or actually are they responsible people that we want to choose and report to? Mention walkie-talkies. We use our software and stuff to notify people. You'll have your own different channels out there. The one thing is we can help with communication. There are tools and products that can help with this, documenting decision making, helping communicate in emergency scenarios. But at the bottom there, no product will make you compliant. And anyone who tells you otherwise is selling and not helping on that. There is stuff that can help 100%, but just be really careful if some people say buy a product will make you Martins Hall compliant. At this stage, I don't think anyone's out there selling holistic solutions, and you don't need to ultimately on that. Yeah, at the bottom, my transparency. I work for Little Green Button. It's a space that I work in, but nothing in this session depends on what we do. And your own plan should stand up, reliant, even if it's tech without technology, you need to think about how you're going to help people in these scenarios. So that was it for me. The scope, lots of premises will be out of scope, but we've spoken about the guidance and the levels there. What are the realistic numbers of attendance? Is that going to set us over? Actually, a lot of the times it probably won't. Control and access, so who controls access, the use and the procedures of that, hiring agreements and how we might update those. And what procedures we need to put in place should the worst happen. We've spoken about evacuation, evacuation, documenting something a bit more enhanced there, specifically for terrorism. But we let's think a little bit wider than that and emergency procedures, emergency services, and how that ropes in there. Just keep it practical and record your reasoning. We've got loads of time to get ready for this. There's loads of guidance out there. I'm going to signpost you to the Security Industry Authority, Home Office, a couple of other great people that are providing some really good content on that. My sources, when I send the slides, I'll show you where I've got a lot of the stuff in there, specific bits of the legislation where you need to look on that. What you're going to find, though, there's going to be a lot of debate on this. Open park events, the big one that we're arguing about at the minute is park run. Anyone that does a park run, is park run ticketed? You have to scan a QR code. Do you have to scan the QR code? I'm not going to go into that. I could go to town on that. We spoke about it in the office for ages and had a good old debate on that. There is going to be more specific guidance and specific use cases. The Home Office have got some great ones for schools. I think firework event is mentioned on the Home Office guidelines. They really talk you through that with the specifics on that. They're going to provide more. You can contact people for guidance on these things, and they're going to provide some really good FAQs around it. Some of this is really nuanced, though. Do the best you can. We'll use the guidance that's out there. But again, it's all about proportionate, not trying to scare people. Just give it a little bit of thought ahead of time and we'll be absolutely fine. That was it from me, guys. Back over to you, John.
Thank you.
Alex.
Question to you, Alex. Is there, I mean, you're talking about the flow chart. If you just asked AI to interview you
Yeah,
about your
basically
event,
for ChatGPT, it's the official
how well does
guidance.
it perform? Yeah.
Really well, and ask it to cite it. But if it's getting its sources from the Home Office or Security Industry Authority, you very much can just double check some of the reasoning and rationale. You'll get a lot of help on that. So, yeah, anyone with a specific use case or example, just double check. It's quite good. Just make sure, ask it to say where it's got the source from. If it's getting its information from the Home Office or Security Industry Authority, just make sure it's not coming from like Barry's blog somewhere that they've made it up.
Cool. Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Alex. That was a great session. Lots of questions. You did a good job in explaining the whole topic. If you wanted to take a step back right now, what's one thing you want your listeners to remember from today?
I think the one thing that we've spoken about is all about proportionate response. This is something that's going to benefit communities, but it doesn't necessarily need to cost them a lot. Not everyone is going to be in scope, but hopefully we've built up some awareness there for them. And we've shown how a couple of small steps now, a couple of enhancements to paperwork and a couple of contract setups and hiring agreements can make a really big difference when we get ahead of that early.
Cool. And a little bit more about yourself. So you said earlier, was it you did international politics and business at uni? Where were you living when you were 18 years old? And what was Alex? What was the vibe of Alex when you were 18? Tell me about him. Introduce me to him.
Yeah, it was busy. I was signed up to lots of different things. I was doing officer training corps at university. I was living in London, in Islington at the time. I signed up to a branch of the TA while I was also
Oh,
studying
the
for my
TA,
degree.
yeah. Cool.
And I was very, very, very busy. I had a part-time job that I was juggling as well, so I was rushing around.
Tesco's?
No, it was Covent Garden. There was an outdoor shop called Trespass.
Oh,
So I
okay,
was,
what year was that?
God, we're going back now, 2010.
Oh, okay, not too. You're young. You're young.
Don't
2010. So you're working at Trespass, doing your TA.
Yeah, and
Sweet.
studying my degree. But it was a busy time, and yeah, trying to find out what my real passion was. That was
Oh, do you really want to? I don't know. Yeah, when I was 18, I don't think I was trying to find out my real passion. But if you wanted to go back and give Alec, if you bumped into him in Covent Garden, in the piazza there, what advice would you give him as he's leaving work after doing a full shift and he's busy?
Don't sweat the small stuff. There's a
Yes.
lot of time thinking back, worrying about inconsequential things. Don't sweat the small stuff. It doesn't lead you anywhere.
Good advice. Good advice. Would he listen?
No, absolutely not. He knew everything back then.
Oh, yes. So we also have a question from the previous guest. This is James Corrigan. This is a tricky one because it's very specific and it's not going to really land if you know nothing about this topic. But I've already given you the question to prepare you. But yeah, what position would you play in rugby and why? Are you a rugby fan first?
This is it was amusing. I'm not a rugby fan. I am not the most this is podcast territory, so you probably won't see my lanky physique. I'm not the most muscular person suited to sport. But I do follow rugby. So that question, what role would I play? A bit of a cheeky answer, but if you've seen the movie Moneyball, my background in statistics, I think I'd probably be someone behind the scenes, that coaching element on the sideline. I was recommended a book actually. It's Legacy by James Kerr. Not sure if you've read it, but it's about sports science and the psychological aspect of the All Blacks. I remember
Yeah.
for a period they really were dominating everything, and it was about their management style, about personalities and confidence, and how they brought that into the sport. That is fascinating. And if I could have a role in rugby, I think it'd be more on the coaching side, behind the scenes. If I had to pick a position, although I don't have the physique for it, is it a fullback? I'd be right at the back trying to spot the danger,
Yeah,
see if I could
good.
block things before they become a crisis.
I think you missed an opportunity. I like your answer. It's good. But it's because your data background, it's not coaching, it's actually analyzing, because the data now is crazy in
Sports
games, you know,
data,
every
great, yeah.
turn, and also, you know, with little green button, it's a device. So, you know, putting devices on players and getting that real-time data and analyzing that,
Absolutely. It's
that's a
those
good,
marginal gains, isn't it? You see it in
yes.
business, but you see it in sport, that 1 or 2% difference. Wow, what that can mean is a knock-on impact. Yeah,
Yeah.
science. Now, Jake Humphries, when you look at the performance behind science, but it's that combination, I think, of the psychological aspect and
Yes.
psychological safety and what that means for team players and communities when they're pulled together, not just about being the biggest and strongest, although in rugby that does help.
Good answer. Okay, so your question for the next guest. Let's go. Wait, wait. Yes, go. Yep.
So my question is, what would be a place, an activity, or a person that makes you feel really safe and grounded? Something where you can switch off from the rest of the world when things get hectic.
I love that. That is a really good question. Yeah, awesome. I know what mine is. It's more the switch off. Because, you know, we're both like leading companies, so it is hectic, families, everything going on. And the only time I am totally switched off is when I'm at Run Club and we've got a very intense training session. You know, you're doing like interval training, like 10 times 500 meter sprints or something like that. And you're just trying to survive the session, and you literally cannot
Your mind
think.
isn't wandering, right, to
No,
other
there's
places
no
rather than
time. You just
going. Yeah.
literally want to get that 500 done, do a bit of recover before the next 500, and you want to get out of the situation actually because it's so intense. You just want it to end. But what I love about it, I didn't think about anything. That's a nice one. Cool, excellent. Thank you very much for coming along today, Alex. Really appreciate that, and hope you had a good time.
Thank you so much, John.